Our next guest on the program is a Peabody and Emmy Award winner. He's the chief investigative and senior national correspondent for CBS News. And as we'll learn, got his start right here in Bangor. We're pleased to be joined on Downtown by Jim Axelrod. Hey, Jim, how are you?
Hey, buddy. How are you?
I am great, thank you. Appreciate you making some time for us today.
Of course. Happy to help.
Well, let's jump right into it here. And let's start about the beginning, which was right here in Bangor, Maine. How did you end up breaking into the news business in Bangor?
Yeah, I didn't know what to do. I was a graduate student studying history, and it was 1988, the fall, and I realized that I was paying a lot more attention to the Bush-Dukakis race than I was to my reading for my history degree. And so I just thought, wait a minute, I may be more interested in the first draft of history than the 100th draft of history. So I thought I might take a crack at TV news, only I had no experience, I hadn't studied it, had never done an internship, didn't know the first thing about it. So I wrote a bunch of letters to people, and there was a wonderful guy who was the news director at WVII in Bangor, a guy named Tim Geyer, who I guess could recognize my desperation and said, you can come on up and hang out in our newsroom and learn a little bit. Can't pay you. I was there for about a week or two. He said, now I can pay you. And I was getting $5 an hour. And I felt like I was the luckiest man in the world because I was learning everything I possibly could about TV news. I wasn't in Bangor very long. I then ended up getting a job in Utica, New York. And so I was gone after like a month, maybe 5 weeks, but I've always been enormously grateful to Tim Geyer and WVII because without Tim and without the station, I'm not sure I'd have a career.
That is wonderful. Well, from there, yeah, you went to Utica, Syracuse, down at WRAL in Raleigh, North Carolina. How did you get to CBS News?
Well, just some good luck, I guess. Raleigh and WRAL-TV was just a fantastic place to work. Family-owned, the Goodman family owned WRAL in Raleigh, still does, Capital Broadcasting. And they had, for a guy who had been in stations that perhaps weren't overly blessed with resources, WRAL had a helicopter on the roof. They had a dedicated reporter to cover the state capitol in Raleigh. That was me. They had a great staff of photographers. So I learned a lot about sort of how to really do this, you know, tell a story. And CBS saw a couple of things. They were a CBS affiliate. And I was able to do a couple of stories that caught some attention and got a shot at CBS, which I guess is now 27 years ago.
Now, yeah, you mentioned you were a history major. I'm a longtime history teacher. What interested you in history, and when, you know, when did you realize that you could combine those passions?
Yeah, I was interested in basically recent modern American political history. So I had written on progressive movement in Wisconsin, the La Follettes, Bob La Follette, and had studied that. I realized, though, that the pursuit of history as a profession, academic history, requires muscles that I hadn't really developed. And so I don't know that I would have been any good at it. I do love history, and I do love understanding, you know, those who forget history are condemned to relive it, the wise man said. And I've always tried to have a grounding, especially in covering certain things such as politics. History is sort of an essential. It's not an option. But I didn't really understand until I was a graduate student at Brown University in Providence that I would be able to take some of what I love, meaning the narrative of what has happened, and apply it to sort of understanding the narrative of what is happening. That's why I think, you know, journalism, broadcast journalism in particular, sort of a natural extension of that for me.
You have traveled the world, including being one of the embedded correspondents for CBS during the time. How do you even prepare for an experience like that as a reporter?
Yeah, you find some people who've done it a bunch of times before. CBS News, of course, had a stable, very gifted war correspondents, photographers, producers. So I was very lucky to be able to take advantage of people in this business who'd been there and done that before. You know, it is a harrowing experience. I was there with the 1st Brigade of the 3rd Infantry as they took Saddam Hussein Airport. And then years later, 8 years later, I was in the last Humvee out of Iraq for the military in December of 2011. So it was quite a bookend of an experience. I sort of learned a lot about my own personal capacity. I don't come from a long line of brave people, as I said before. But, you know, nothing focuses you as much as something like the danger of covering conflict. Also have time and place where the military was a particularly prominent part of my life. I gained an enormous respect for the men and women of the United States military and their capacity to do their jobs under the most extraordinarily difficult set of conditions. So all in all, while it certainly left me quite shaken, and there were some obvious sort of fallout from watching, you know, the beginning of a war unfold at the end of a war, or at least the end of the active phase of involvement, it also sort of deepened my understanding of the world in which we live.
We're talking with Jim Axelrod here, a story and a unique perspective on one of the biggest news stories of the last 25 or probably even 50 years, and that's the events of 9/11.
Yeah. Well, 9/11 is a lot of things to a lot of people. For me, it was also my 8th wedding anniversary. We were there first. and so I was home a little bit later than my normal day. I just had an extra cup of coffee with my wife. Got on my bus to go to the city, couldn't get through the Lincoln Tunnel, and suddenly began to get on what at that point were pagers. I just kept getting the number to call the newsroom, and finally I got through and was told what was happening. I was 5 or 6 miles away, but I might as well have been 1,000 miles away in terms of my ability to get there. Finally got in late in the afternoon, and 2 weeks later was in Afghanistan. So it was another sort of harrowing experience, but I didn't realize this till many, many, many years later. I was at the 9/11 Museum, which I highly recommend to anybody who's ever in New York City as a tourist. You got to go to the 9/11 Museum. It is just a moving, spectacularly done, but a deeply emotional place to spend some time. And when I got to one part of the exhibit, I looked up and they were saying, oh, the name Ground Zero, Ground Zero. And I'm like following this and I'm like, it's that odd experience, but I'm seeing my name. And I guess the folks did the research and I have no recollection of this. I remember using the term, but I was given credit for using Ground Zero in relation to 9/11. I was the first journalist to do that. So I've always, it's just an odd connection to a horrendous, horrible day in American history that I didn't even know I had until, you know, many, many, many years later.
You won a Peabody Award for your series on the opiate crisis in West Virginia, a crisis that still continues to plague us in rural areas of Maine, and we're dealing with the same thing.
Yeah. The thing I remember the most was feeling there was a wonderful coal miner, Willis Duncan, who has since passed away. And he was explaining to us he had suffered an injury in the mines, and he had had some of his sort of the chest area had been really, he said, the way that, you know, the doctors and the insurance industry, the way it was handled back then was go somewhere and they'd write you a piece of paper and you take pills, and he was hooked. And I guess it was the most, in his view, cost-effective or expedient way of handling it. And I just remember feeling like, really? The best we can do? He said he was never talked to about it, never asked any questions about it. Just would roll in, hand him the paper, and off he'd go. And it was our entree into understanding this scourge that has ransacked so many communities especially, as you say, in rural America, where you have, you know, towns 400 or 500 and the pharmacy. In one place, Kermit, West Virginia, where we were, it was a town of 400, and the guy who owned the local pharmacy cleared a profit of $6 million that year. Something's not right. Something wasn't right then. Something's still not right now. And I don't, for the life of me, I understand what the motivation is and the incentive and why we end up this way, but there are a generation or two of people who are suffering and whose suffering is not addressed by anything other than writing them a prescription. And I can't think of anything more wrong in our culture over the last several decades.
You and your crew did tremendous work on reporting on the end of the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy and some heartbreaking stories about members of the military.
Yeah, and this one is absolutely inexcusable. We had Don't Ask, Don't Tell. The policy of the United States military was reversed and ended. It'll be a dozen years ago, this September, that Don't Ask, Don't Tell was repealed. And you still have thousands and thousands of veterans who have earned benefits they cannot access because their discharge has not been sufficiently upgraded to reflect their service. In fact, they are still being penalized for their sexuality. They're being targeted for their sexuality. They are paying a price to this day, even though the policy is no longer in place because of their sexuality, and we can't get the Pentagon to comment. We have another story coming up in a couple of weeks, and we will continue following this because, you know, the veterans, the VA certainly has found a workaround to provide some of these veterans with the benefits that they long since earned but can't access. But the Pentagon still won't address this. And so we keep asking this question, why so many years later will the Pentagon not address this clear injustice that affects thousands and thousands of veterans? And I keep asking a question, is it bureaucratic inertia or is it lingering homophobia? And I still can't get anyone from the Pentagon to answer that straight up.
Jim, is it more difficult for journalists to cover politics these days when you have, in many cases, not just politicians, but voters who live in seemingly entirely different universes?
Yeah, you know, it is a very challenging time, obviously the most challenging environment, I think, for journalists. And I think all you can really do as a journalist is do your work in a way that is transparent and it stands up to examination and reflects sort of the best ethics and approach to the job. You can't control, you know, as I always say to my kids, about anything, you control process, not outcome. I can't control what somebody's going to think of my work. And I can control, and the only thing I can control is the process that I use to complete my work. So as long as I feel that I'm telling a story in an ethical manner that reflects the best traditions of CBS News and the best traditions of broadcast journalism, then what am I going to do if somebody comes after me on Twitter? You know, we recently did a story about, I'll give you a perfect example. So we broke the story about the whistleblower in the Hunter Biden case, who was the IRS agent, supervisory agent, who said that he was treated in a way, the investigation was impeded in a way that he hadn't run into in all his time at the IRS. And we put this on. And suddenly, very interesting, I started hearing from all kinds of people who I never heard from or only heard from in a critical way, saying, oh, you're finally doing your job well. And then I heard from other people who, you know, had sort of always been longtime viewers saying, what's wrong with you? Like, why are you doing this? Why are you giving this guy airtime? Nothing had changed in my approach to the work. The only thing that had changed was I had alienated one group of people who had been folks who were regular viewers, and I had done some story that appealed to the viewer who generally was always accusing the place I work with a liberal bias. So what's it really all about, Rich? Is it about the work I'm doing, or is it about the people who are viewing it?
That's the eternal question right there. I reached out to you after seeing your wonderful piece a couple of weeks ago in CBS Sunday Morning about Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. What a wonderfully fascinating guy he is.
My goodness, what a deep thinker. It was such a treat. You know, he's been, it's funny, at 15 or 16, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar was on the Ed Sullivan Show. He was put in, illuminated with our brightest cultural lights available, and he stayed there for the last almost 60 years, more than 60 years, actually. So to me, I was fascinated by the fact that all a basketball fan might know about this guy is that he did remarkable things physically, right? He was the all-time NBA leading scorer when he retired. I think he made 19 all-star teams. He won 6 championships, 6 MVPs. So he had all of this record of doing things physically, but intellectually, that what was driving him is intellectual development. He's a deep thinker. He told us a couple of things we couldn't put on the air, but he was telling us that while he, you know, wanted to be Will Chamberlain, he wanted to be Willie Mays more, he said he loved baseball. He wanted to be Miles Davis more than both of them. And I said, Miles Davis, you love jazz. I mean, we know Kareem Abdul-Jabbar loves jazz. He goes, basketball is jazz. Now, what an interesting thought that is, the improvisational nature of that game. He has been thinking deep thoughts for decades. And you might not know because, you know, people think, oh, Kareem skyhook. No. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar is a brilliant, deep thinker.
Well, another deep thinker that you spoke with recently was Bruce Springsteen, looking back at the making of his Nebraska album. And to me, that's such an interesting decision that he made at that point in his career. He'd come off the huge success of The River and then to make this intimate, deeply personal and not terribly commercial album.
You know, what's beautiful about that, aside from a guy from New Jersey getting to sit and talk to him for a couple of hours, he was really connected to the notion that he wanted people to understand the valley he was walking through at the time that he made Nebraska. So he was coming off the River tour. It was before the Born in the USA tour, but he was a rock star in every sense of the word. And yet he was having a great deal of despair in his life. He was at a personal crossroads. He was wondering why the success wasn't translating into any sustained sense of well-being. Now, that's a pretty sophisticated point, and certainly a highly personal point. And his wanting to share that, I felt, was sort of deeply meaningful and sort of putting himself in service to a lot of people to say, hey, I said to him in the interview, I said, I guess you can't succeed your way out of pain. And he said, no, you cannot. As if that was the most important thought that he wanted to get across to people was, you know, no matter what you do in life, no matter how many houses you have, no matter how much money you make, no matter if you're Bruce Springsteen, if you're one of the world's great rock stars, that is no guarantee that there are not going to be things you have to stare down in life that no amount of success is going to insulate you from. I thought that was, you know, in our current sort of culture, you don't hear the 5-star, high-wattage, bold-faced names speak in those honest, searingly honest terms about the pain that's just part of life.
Well, it was a great conversation. And Jim, you've carved out such a wonderful position for yourself with CBS. You're the chief investigative correspondent. You're covering hard news. You're doing investigative reporting. You're interviewing incredibly interesting people. It's got to feel good after, you know, 27 years there and what, nearly, what, 35 or so in the business to be at a point where you get to do so much that's both important and interesting and introspective in many ways.
Well, you're very, very kind, and I deeply appreciate. I don't think of it in those terms, so I'm grateful to hear you sum it up that way. All I can say is it is such a privilege to be able to you know, sort of make a living doing this kind of work. I think you know this instinctively, Richie, like we understand the world as human beings through stories. I think we've done that since we were living in caves, right? We sit around the fire and we tell stories to each other. And that's how we understand life. And so being able to make a living telling stories, although ours are, you know, sort of always rooted in fact, but stories nonetheless, I just feel like it's been quite a blessing to be able to make a living doing that kind of work.
Well, it's great to finally have a chance to talk with you here. We appreciate you carving out some time for us. And now, of course, every time we see you on television or we talk about one of your great pieces here, we'll always preface it with Jim Axelrod, who, by the way, started his career in Bangor, Maine.
Well, listen, you are such a gentleman, and I so deeply appreciate you spending a few minutes, allowing me to spend a few minutes with you and your listeners, and thank you.
Well, we appreciate it. Keep doing what you're doing, and we'll talk again down the road.
I hope so. Take good care.